Morning. At this time, we're on record in Packer versus Riverbend Communications, LLC. And as such, Mr. Browning is representing Packer and on behalf of Riverbend, Sean Bailey. Are there any preliminary matters by either party?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very well. We will proceed. Mr. Browning.
Thank you. May it please the court. The facts in this case, Your Honors, Nicole Packer answered an invitation to participate in a Christmas expo. Riverbend was putting on the expo. Jay Dye was Riverbend's agent on the scene. Jay Dye demanded that Nicole use one exit, the rear exit, and not the others. Nicole did not have to use any exit until closing time. She took a handful of belongings with her. As Jay Dye demanded, she used the rear door. As she exited, the door slammed shut behind her. She was in darkness. She then proceeded toward the parking lot to her right and fell off the edge, not knowing that she was on a loading dock. There was a light above the door, but the light was not illuminated when Nicole exited. Does she know who turned off the light or if it was broken? No. Does it matter? No. We sued Riverbend, who put on the expo. We also sued the owner of the building, Kingston and VK Enterprises. Both defendants, Riverbend and Kingston, filed summary judgment motions. The issues were different for the two different defendants. Kingston had done nothing but own a building with alleged dangerous defects. They were released on summary judgment. We're not appealing against them. We're appealing against Riverbend, who we sued on a theory of negligence. The district court dismissed this case at the urging of Riverbend, finding that the controlling issue was whether Nicole was a licensee or an invitee. It said that Mr. Dye did not have a duty to check to see if the doorway was safe. And that's why we're here today. Frankly, Your Honors, we did not even plead premises liability as to this defendant. The only theory of liability we raised in our complaint as to this defendant was negligence, pure and simple. I'm going to take my argument time to read portions of the complaint I drafted as to this defendant to demonstrate how frivolous this argument of the defendant is. I'll be starting at paragraph 8 of our complaint, and I'll skip paragraph 9 because that applies only to the owners of the building, Kingston and DK Enterprises. I'll then read paragraphs 10 and 11 of our complaint, so there will be no doubt that this defendant has raised a frivolous argument that plaintiff did not plead negligence as to Riverbend. Paragraph 8, quote, on or about December 4th, 2015, plaintiff Nicole Packer was leaving a Christmas expo sponsored by Riverbend Communications and Riverbend Events at Kingston Plaza in Idaho Falls, Bonneville County, Idaho. Ms. Packer began to leave the Christmas Expo and was directed to use a door located at the back of the building by an employee supervising the expo on behalf of Riverbend Communications and Riverbend Events. Nicole had not used this exit before, but was told by this agent of Riverbend Communications and Riverbend Events that the other doors were out of commission and could not be used. Nicole Packer used this back door as directed by the Riverbend Communications employee, who was working at the Christmas Expo. At this time, there was a light outside the door, but the light was not working. As the plaintiff exited the building, as directed, the door closed and locked behind her as she could not re-enter the building. It was dark out at that time, and she could not see anything except the distant lights toward the parking lot area. She took a couple of steps toward the parking area lights and fell several feet straight down off an unlit loading dock because she could not see the loading dock when she fell. Now I'll skip paragraph 9 and go to paragraph 10. Quote, the actions of the employee agent of Riverbend Communications, LLC and Riverbend Events were the actions of the defendant, Riverbend Communications, LLC, by virtue of agency law and respondeat superior. The employee's act of directing the plaintiff toward an unmarked and dangerous exit was negligent and was a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. Number 11. As a direct and proximate result of the aforementioned actions, the plaintiff, Nicole Packer, was caused to suffer serious, painful, debilitating, and permanent injuries and have caused her economic and non-economic losses in an amount to be proved at trial. Those injuries include, but are not limited to, bulging cervical and lumbar spine discs, knee sprain, cervicalgia, left and right arm pain, back pain, and soft tissue. Plaintiff has incurred medical bills in the amount no less than $21,106.79 and may have suffered a loss of income earning capacity as well. Now, I'd also like to read two excerpts from the summary judgment transcript of July 14th, 2019. This was our first argument to the court. We argued basic negligence. Judge Pickett did not want to hear it. Frankly, Judge Pickett kept directing me away from arguments on negligence. He wanted to talk about other things, but I raised the issue and I argued the issue to Judge Pickett. Now, going to page 46 of the transcript, at lines 8 through 15, I quote, there we're talking about what's the duty. I mean, and then Mr. Browning, quote, okay, as far as the duty, it's to tell, you know, to, if you are going to instruct people to go through a particular way, you have a duty to make sure that you're instructing them in a safe manner, you know, that you are in control of the premises. And then again, at page 48, lines 7 through 12, quote, Mr. Browning, they have a duty. They should be aware if they were instructing people to go out that door. If they're instructing people to leave by that door, as they did for Nicole, then they have a duty to make sure they're instructing them to go out a safe door. That's what I'm saying. So just so there's no doubt, in the brief of the respondent, they said that we didn't raise it in our complaint. They said that we didn't argue it. It's absolutely false. It's just as I've demonstrated to you. Now, the court's finding and the respondent's argument that we did not plead negligent is false. The respondent's argument that we did not argue negligence to the court in this case is also false. We pled and we argued negligence to the district court, and they threw us out anyway, even though we had facts in the record to establish the cause we pled. So our complaint was not.
Mr. Browning, so is the crux of your argument today that assumption of a duty by Riverbend is the theory under which the case should proceed?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So you're talking about restatement second, section 311?
I believe so.
Is there any other cause of action that you're pleading or that you're...
We just pled. I'm sorry.
Is there any other theory of liability that you're pursuing?
Nope, just one.
And you're abandoning premises liability?
We didn't even plead premises liability as to this defendant. We pled negligence, and that's what we're going under, Your Honor.
So premises liability should not be considered by us?
I think it's a red herring, Your Honor. That was a defense raised by the defendant. And I maintain to the court that it's irrelevant as to what the status of the plaintiff is when the plaintiff is directed to do a particular action upon land. If we're talking about premises liability concerns someone who is given permission or rents a piece of land and somehow gets injured on the land by their own doing and they weren't warned of a particular danger. When you're directed to do a specific act on the land, the person who is directing you to do that thing is bearing the responsibility that he's giving you safe directions.
So do you have any authority from this court previously in which we have adopted Section 311 of the Second Restatement of Torts?
I would say, Your Honor, that from the time I was a law clerk at the Supreme Court to all the decisions that I've read, the court commonly adopts the restatement view of courts and uses it as guidance.
That's not exactly my question. My question is, have we ever embraced Section 311 of the Second Restatement of Torts?
Off the top of my head, I can't say, Your Honor, one way or the other.
We have said that negligent misrepresentation, which this would arguably fall under, only applies to an accountant, haven't we?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with where the court is going there.
I'm trying to ascertain what we have said in the past and to make sure that I have a clear understanding. And my thought was, that we have only embraced negligent misrepresentation in a very narrow situation, and I think that's with an accountant.
Your Honor, this doesn't have anything to do with negligent misrepresentation. This has to do with an order to do something by someone on the scene.
Well, the section 311 of the second restatement is entitled negligent misrepresentation involving risk of physical harm. How is it anything other than a negligent misrepresentation?
Okay. It is a, if you have a negligent misrepresentation, Your Honor, that's, I think that applies when you're giving the plaintiff options to do one thing or another. This plaintiff didn't have an option. This plaintiff was given a direction and order. This plaintiff was not told that, you know, the different exits that we have in this building are safe, you know, whether it's the south or the east, you know, pick, you know, do what you want. This specifically applies to a case where the person on the scene is giving someone an order to do something, not options. And so I would say it takes it out of that, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Browning, you're suggesting that negligent misrepresentation only applies when the plaintiff has an actual choice, rather than is only confronted with one option?
Basically, I guess it could be, you know, you could, a plaintiff might rely on that for some implied representation, which is one way of reading this.
Wouldn't the plaintiff always have the choice not to follow the direction?
I would argue no. You're talking about reasonableness. What would the reasonable person do? The reasonable person who is renting a space in here from Riverbend, there's one person on scene directing them what they are to do, what the vendors are supposed to do. And she does what they tell them to do. They tell her where to set up, she goes there. They tell her where to exit, she does that. And they told her to exit basically off a cliff, and she didn't have any idea. And I would say it's, you know, it's kind of similar to if you had a traffic cop in an area that was directing traffic, and he's out there directing people. Okay, you go this way, you know, you go to the right here, and the right happens to be the bridge is out, and you drive off the edge of the bridge. It's not a defense, you know, for the state being sued on behalf of the, you know, as under the cop's actions on the basis that the cop didn't know the bridge was out. If you are taking the responsibility of telling people how to do things, and you have the authority to do that, as Jade and I did in this place, then you have the absolute responsibility to make sure that you're doing that safely. So I would say if any of the other justices have a question, I think it's a difference that I have, you know, with the court statement there, with Your Honor's statement, was, again, this is not a question of options. You know, you can go this way or that way. You know, if you go this way, it might be safe. And I think that was actually one of the cases raised by the respondent in their brief. But we have a different case because this is not one dealing with, you know, if you go down this way, it's safe. This is the case of Nicole Packer, you know, specifically directed, you must go out this exit. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. On behalf of the respondent, Mr. Bailey.
Oh, I'm not done.
Oh. No problem. I'm sorry. I thought when you said thank you, you were done.
Dramatic.
No, I'm just a thankful person, Your Honor.
Well, aren't we all?
Amen.
Excuse me, Mr. Browning.
No problem, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Not done. And as to lessor lessee, what makes this case different from premises liability? Again, I think it sounds like the justices understand this. Is that the respondent's agent on the scene, Jay Dye, was not just sitting on leased property saying nothing. He was in charge. He demanded that certain action be taken. That is, that Nicole use the back door when she was to exit. And when I drafted the complaint in this case, I remembered that we covered this in law school, if you instruct someone to do something, you have the responsibility to make sure that it's safe for the person to do that. That's basic negligence. And the facts are clear in this case that it was dangerous outside that door when Ms. Packer used the exit. Does it matter that she was given the instruction earlier in the day? No, because she didn't have to, you know, when she was going to exit the premises, it was going to be when the expo was over. And that's when it was dark, again, it's Christmas time. So she went out at night and she was only given one option, you know, one place where she could exit. It was a command and she followed the command. I'm just going to look. I think some of the things in my argument we've already covered. And so I think I may be able to skip those.
Mr. Browning?
Yes, Your Honor.
In reading the trial court's decision on reconsideration, the judge appears to be suggesting that although you may have at least given lip service to the idea of just common negligence, that it was impossible to separate the premise liability theories from negligence. You couldn't just do this as a negligence case, that premise liability was part and parcel of the claim. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that makes it similar to a premises liability claim is that our person was, in a sense, on leased property. She was leasing a space there. And if the property owner, that is actually the property possessor in this case, Riverbend, had done nothing but just leased her the space, then we'd have questions arising. If she'd gotten hurt just from wandering about the property and exiting the south exit, then we would be talking about premises liability because that would have been something that she did on her own. And so I think when we're talking about premises liability, we're talking about dangers that the plaintiff doesn't know about and maybe she should have been warned about. But those are all in the absence of being given a specific direction to do something that in fact is dangerous. So that's the difference. And if anybody has any questions on that, I'd proceed. Okay. So again, when you have the power, let's see. There were some other things raised by the respondent in their response brief and actually on summary judgment, I'm not going to address because I think the jury arguments, you know, as to whether Nicole could have done something different, you know, she's got stuff in her hands and respondent brings up, well, you know, she's got a cell phone in her pants pocket. Okay. Well, you know, most cell phones have a flashlight on there. We don't know that she even knew that or knew how to use that. Frankly, I didn't know that my cell phone had a flashlight until that was brought to my attention by the defense in this case. So I think that's, you know, those are all jury arguments. And I think they're absolutely improper, you know, for judging whether the plaintiff can go ahead and go to trial. So I think with that, I believe that I've covered it. Thank you. And this time I am sitting down. Thank you.
I'm a little gun shy.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Mr. Bailey, on behalf of the respondent, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Burdick. May it please the court, counsel. I anticipated that we would be arguing a few more issues than it appears that we are. So I will follow the chief's lead, and I'll try to be brief and minimize the pain for you folks. The case, I think, really does boil down to that single issue, is whether or not a vendor at a trade show is a licensee or an invitee. I submit that it's not really a complicated question in this case and that the district court did get it correct. The Idaho Supreme Court has long said that the determinations of such issues of status for someone who is injured or who brings a claim on while visiting someone else's premises is determined based upon your purpose for being there, based upon the visitor's purpose for being on the premises. I'm not entirely sure I understand plaintiff's approach on this. I do believe that the court was right, and I've often, frankly, had difficulty knowing when ordinary negligence versus premises liability negligence is separates. I think that they do overlap to a large extent. And so I'm a little bit uncertain how to argue this, because I don't think Mr. Browning actually answered Justice Stegner's question about whether or not he was abandoning this premises liability theory. So I'll touch on that. If I don't need to, you folks can certainly cut me off.
But so Mr. Bailey,
yes, sir.
If we're going to talk about premises liability, one of the ways in which we determine whether someone is an invitee is where it can be reasonably said that the visit may confer a business, commercial, monetary, or other tangible benefit to the possessor. How is this anything other than that?
Well, because there is an exception to that rule. Remember, if the benefit being conferred by the visitor is inconsequential or minor, as we have from the Holzheimer and Johansson case, the Mooney and Robinson case going back to 1970 and more recently 1974, and then I think I had a third one floating around here. Those situations, I think, are where we are in this case. No question that Mrs. Packer paid a minor fee for the rental. I mean, she became a licensee in another sense of the word licensee, because she rented a booth there.
But why don't we determine the duty owed to her by Riverbend through the relationship she has with Riverbend? It looks like a pure commercial transaction to me.
Well,
for that, she should be an invitee.
Well, no, I think it is. Again, we have to look at the reason that the visitor is on the premises. And that is what has been looked at in both the Mooney case and in the Holzheimer case, where there was a minor benefit. For example, remember the Mooney case. That's where they're buying a dog and they deliver a substantial portion of the purchase price, but they're also there visiting as a house guest with the defendants. And the court there said, now the purpose in her being there was the social visit. It wasn't really the purchase of the dog. That was an incidental or a minor consideration. And the real reason for her being there was the social visit. Similarly, the Holzheimer case.
But I'm not sure that analogy bears fruit for you, because there's nothing to suggest that Mrs. Packer was on the premises for a social purpose, wasn't there?
Well, no, not necessarily a social purpose, but in Holzheimer and Johansson, it wasn't a social purpose either. Remember, that's the fellow who's borrowing fruit boxes from another fruit farmer, and he's buying some at cost, and he's just going to replace some. And the court there in 1994 held that, no, that was not the main purpose for being there. The reason that he was there was just because that was a common practice among fruit farm owners to lend those boxes to one another. And it was an issue of goodwill among the community of growers there. And what they would do is they would, when they had extra boxes, they would sell them at cost, or they would give them to the fellow who needed them in an effort to try to earn a favor that when they needed them, they could go back. And so that was not the real reason that the fellow was there, wasn't to conduct a transaction with the defendant, Johansson. He was there because he was there for his own benefit. We look at what his real motivation for being there was. It was to get fruit boxes that he needed for his harvest. Just like the real reason that the woman plaintiff in Mooney was at the Robinson home was for a social visit. And the real reason that Ms. Packer was at the fair was to promote her own business, to promote her yoga classes, to promote her yoga adventures, and to sell her supplements, that sort of thing. She would have been there. I think we can reasonably assume, in fact, Judge, that if there had been no fee to rent the booth, that she'd have been allowed to come there for free, she would have been there, because she was willing to pay a small fee to rent the booth. So it wasn't the business transaction that motivates her presence there. It was the opportunity to meet with a lot of potential customers or to renew meetings with old customers. That's why she was there. And thus she's a licensee. The main purpose for her being there wasn't to go rent property. She wasn't renting a home to live in. She was there for the sole purpose of promoting her business, thus benefiting herself. And that's one of the problems with plaintiff's case here, if I may touch on that for just a moment. As the district court found time and again, the plaintiff failed to provide evidence to support the triggering of a duty or the breach of a duty by the defendant. One of the problems with all of this is we don't know whether there was a benefit conferred to Riverbend by the plaintiff. We don't know what.
Certainly, isn't there an inference to be drawn to that effect?
Well, there is an inference, but we don't know if it was a
substantial. Isn't Packer entitled to that inference at summary judgment?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, I think it's clear that the inference inures to her benefit, and that there is a clear implication that she paid Riverbend to attend.
Well, I think that's partly correct, and I would add one bit of information for you. And it goes back to the Holzheimer case. If I'm not mispronouncing that, I probably am. But the long and the short of that case is they were selling some of the boxes to the plaintiff at cost. So you could make that same argument there, Judge, that there's some benefit to the defendant with the presence of Mr. Holzheimer collecting food or fruit boxes. What we don't know here is whether or not there was even any profit or even any net benefit to Riverbend. They may have been leasing these for just a mere portion of the cost that would be attributable to each booth. We don't know that. The point is that the plaintiff has not put on any evidence whatsoever of what benefit, if any, flows from Mrs. Packer to the defendants in this case. None whatsoever. We're assuming, and we might give them an inference that there was some benefit, but in order to fit within the case law of Idaho, you have to determine whether it is anything more than an incidental benefit or just a minor benefit. That's what's missing from this.
Well, why is Riverbend doing this other than to obtain money from the vendors that lease the space from Riverbend?
Well, this again isn't in the record, but what I can tell you is that they're a radio station. They promote their radio and they promote their advertisers on the radio with these things. That's their benefit to it. They don't get their real benefit isn't from the vendors that are there. Their benefit is from the people that show up and listen to the music and listen to the advertisers that they have acquired that put on ads in between the music while they're there. These are live broadcast type things that we all are familiar with.
And isn't that the benefit of having all these vendors there for the radio station?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the first
isn't
part.
Isn't that the economic benefit for the radio station that the vendor gives by being present, not only their rental, which I have a real hard time saying is not a business operation. But in addition, if in fact the benefit is we attract a lot of people to look at the goods and then they love us on the radio, et cetera, that's a business advantage. That is a business advantage for Riverbend, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with you.
Then how can it be a minuscule benefit?
Well, that's the thing. We don't know. We don't have any evidence in the
Do you really think that a plaintiff has got to go in to the books of Riverbend and prove how much profit they made from this before they can have a cause of action on a premise liability case? Where's the law that says that?
Well, I think the law is that in the Holzheimer case and in the Mooney case, for example, the plaintiff needs to be able to show that what benefit they confer, now not the other visitors, remember, not the customers of the various vendors or the customers of the radio station.
So as you have more customers,
your rights are diminished.
Not necessarily.
Well, that's what you said, Mr. Bailey. If there's a whole lot of folks, they don't have as many rights as if there's one person renting this building.
Well, no, I don't think that's exactly what I was intending to say. If that's what I said, then I made a mistake.
Well, I've made mistakes already in this hearing, so.
I'm sorry?
I've made mistakes already in this hearing, so that's okay.
I'm in good company then. That's all right.
You may proceed, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. The point is that it isn't just a question of whether or not there's a business transaction. That's not the end of the inquiry that has to be made. The court has long said and has always held, there's no reason to change that. In this world, there isn't necessarily going to be an absolutely clear transaction that is one type or another. The fact of the matter is that the court has drawn a distinction and says, if there is just a minor or incidental benefit that's conferred by the visitor to the landowner, then that is not adequate to change your status from a licensee to an invitee. And that's exactly what we have here. More to the point, as was found by the district court, we don't have any facts to judge that with. The plaintiff failed to provide any proof of that, one way or the other, that there was a substantial benefit or a minimal benefit. So they're not entitled to an inference that it was an adequate benefit to change her status from a licensee to an invitee. There just is no proof to support that. Now, one issue I want to take with Mr. Browning as to the facts that I think are important is he wants to argue that the plaintiff was compelled to take this route out the back door. And that's just simply in error. As I said, her sole purpose in being there was to attend the show. On the morning of the show, as you can see from the record, volume 1, pages 72 and 73, which is her deposition, pages 48 and 49. On the morning of the show, the plaintiff first entered the building through the front doors, the main entrance. She registered there. She made one trip to her booth with some of her items. There were no adverse repercussions. She wasn't forced to go around someplace else. She later went through the west door. And to give you sort of an overview, this is an old Ernst store. Some of you may be old enough to remember Ernst, but it's an old hardware store, essentially. And it had a dual front entrances. It on the north of the building, it had the rear entrance on the south that is the subject of this discussion, and it had another side entrance on the west side. After she registered, after she made her first trip through the front entrance, then Ms. Packer goes to the west side because that was closer to where her booth was. And she then continued to load her items into her booth from her vehicle. No one prohibited her from using the front door. That wasn't the issue. What happened was, and Mr. Carey, the other lawyer in this case, and I want to read parts of her deposition transcript, ask her this specific question. On page 58, beginning at line 9, he said, okay, here's what I'm trying to get at. Jay Dye told you not to use the west door. Did he tell you not to use any other door in the building? Answer, no, no. Mr. Carey, so when you answer, but he did say that he didn't really want me going through the front door because I thought it was weird to use, question, taking stuff into the booth? Yes, yes. So the whole point of this was that he was asking her not to take her materials in through the front door, take it through the side door, which she did. Then she goes on. Did he tell you to use what particular door on the back to use? And this is on page 59 of her deposition. Her answer, I thought it was weird because that's not the way I've ever done it. But he did specify and direct me that it was where the food vendor exit. I can't quote his exact words, but I wanted clarification. It was very clear, not a doubt in my mind, that it was this door. And I knew that the food vendors used that door as well. Then she goes on page 60. Was the door on the back that you went out, whether it was the one Jay intended or not, was it marked as a vendor exit or anything like that? No. It seemed to me like this was something that came up maybe unexpected-like. Hey, we're having an issue. This is the gist of the words. This is the door here. So we're asking vendors to go through the back. That's an important distinction over what Mr. Browning is trying to portray, whether it is a negligence claim or a premises liability. Mr. Dye asked her to use the front door. He did not have authority as is required under this restatement section 311 that's been discussed briefly. He did not have authority to compel her to go one direction or another. He's not like a police officer who would have the authority of the law to direct a vehicle one spot or another. He just asked her to use that door. He did not require it. And the long and the short of this is, plaintiff had another avenue. If she got to the back door, looked out, saw that it was dark, she did not have to go out that door. She knew that. She'd already entered through the front door. She was requested to use the back door, not required. And there is nothing in this record that demonstrates any authority of Mr. Dye over the plaintiff or any authority that he could compel her to act one way or the other. In fact, we know from the undisputed facts she acted differently from what Mr. Dye was requesting.
So, Mr. Bailey, you're saying that it's we can reasonably infer that she was requested to use the loading dock exit?
Yes, I think that's appropriate. She was requested to do so. But that's not the end of the inquiry again. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, as we cited in our brief, a person can't, and the case law supports this, a person can't just encounter a danger without using common sense. Remember that
that's a different question for purposes of summary judgment. Her negligence won't obviate or can't be the basis for directing summary judgment in favor of the defendants, can it?
Well, yes, I think it can. And I would phrase the question just a little bit differently. I think that what happens is when the plaintiff goes out and sees that it's dark and feels that it's not safe to go where she is intending to go, and when the plaintiff has a different option, then the duty of the landowner or the duty of the defendant in an ordinary negligence case does not arise. Remember what we have said in the Supreme Court. The duty of a landowner, and I submit just an ordinary defendant in an ordinary negligence case, is based upon the issue of superior knowledge about the property. The issue of, do you know about in advance a hazardous condition that this person may encounter when they're on the property? That's your duty to a licensee and to an invitee for that matter. You have to disclose that if you know or reasonably should have known about a problem. And I'll talk about missing evidence in a moment. But the fact of the matter is once the plaintiff has that knowledge, whether it be by warning from the defendant or whether it be by her own experience, then the duty of the defendant doesn't arise. We don't have a duty to protect them any longer because the landowner does not have superior knowledge to the plaintiff. She knows.
Mr. Bailey, go ahead.
So I appreciated your comments when you started about the difficulty sometimes in premises liability cases separating the premises liability from ordinary negligence. And it seems to me that this court addressed that distinction many years ago in McDonald versus Safeway Stores, which was the case where Safeway was conducting demonstrations and the lady slipped on the ice cream. That was the issue. And in that case, Safeway argued that the lady could not bring what I'll call an ordinary negligence type claim. And this court clarified that it's a little bit different than that. One of the discussions is Safeway argues that the McDonald's claim of negligence was based on two distinct theories. The first being that the Safeway employees had actual or constructive knowledge of the dangerous condition and failed to remedy it. And the second being that by permitting three separate demonstrations on a busy sales day and furnishing ice cream to infants, Safeway created a foreseeable risk of harm to its customers. And Safeway argued that second theory, that it should have been granted summary judgment on that, that that was not proper premises liability. And this court disagreed. And so my question is this: why isn't the plaintiff's claim that that this fellow directing or requesting that the plaintiff use a loading dock exit to exit the building created a foreseeable risk of harm, regardless of whether Riverbend knew that the light was out or that the door locked, but that just using or requesting that vendors use a loading dock to exit the building was unreasonable?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the very end of that question.
Just that requesting that people use a loading dock to exit the building is unreasonable, that it's an unreasonable risk of harm.
Well, we don't have any evidence of that. What we do have, however, is evidence that the food vendors were back there and were using that as their entrance and exit from the expo. They had their food trailers out there and they were coming back and forth with no incident whatsoever. That's the other problem with the plaintiff's proof, is they haven't documented or presented any evidence whatsoever that Mr. Dye was aware of a problem with the lights, was aware of any problem allegedly with the door. I mean, I submit to you that we can infer without much problem that there probably was no such problem going on with the door or
but
with
that's
the lights.
That's what Safeway argued. Safeway argued there was no evidence that they knew that the ice cream was on the floor.
And I'm getting to that. I think there is a difference in the case we have here and the Safeway case or the, and I have it here, the case where we have a continuous or recurring situation. And that's really been refined since the Safeway case, I think. And I'll try and find the case for you. I think it's the Brooks versus Walmart case involving the floor cleaners that leaked on the floor. There, the court did say, well, yeah, it's a continuous or
said operational.
Operational, correct. And we don't have that here. We have one patron that has had a problem and they asked her to leave through one door as out of three that she had an option to leave through. That was not a continuous or a repeated situation that was set up by the landowner that creates this different standard. And so I think the Brooks and Walmart case address that right on point. No duty arises if the plaintiff fails to show that the defendant had knowledge of these problems or had constructed a continuous risk situation. And we know from the plaintiff's own testimony that the food vendors were going in and out of that door, and that wasn't a risk. We have no other complaints, no other problems with that. And they didn't have problems falling off the loading dock or anything of that sort. So it's not the same as Safeway case.
Excuse me, it seems to me my
grocery store is mixed up, but the Safeway case or the Brooks and Walmart case.
Excuse me, sir.
That case follows Tomra and flat out says that an owner is not an insurer, There's no presumption of negligence simply because of an accident. And the basis of the owner's liability is the superior knowledge of a dangerous condition. Without proof of that superior knowledge, no duty arises in the defendant. That's the law that is controlling in this case, in my view.
Excuse me, can you hear me, Mr. Bailey?
I'm sorry?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
I think I wrote Brooks, but if not, I was certainly involved in it. And as such, one of the issues, again, was much like the Safeway store, and that was the issue of foreseeability, not only the duty. Walmart tried to pawn the duty off on the people who set up the kiosk.
Yes,
but the other issue was foreseeability that, in fact, if you bring in wet floor machines on a regular basis, that it's foreseeable that there will, in fact, be water on that floor. And if, in fact, you are letting people out a door that doesn't have a light, isn't that an issue of foreseeability?
Well, it would be if, in fact, the land possessor, if in fact Riverbend or Mr. Dye knew of that. But that's the problem here, is there's no evidence whatsoever in this record anywhere that Mr. Dye or Riverbend had knowledge of the alleged problem with the door or the alleged problem with the light. There's no evidence as to how long this light was out, if it was. And as Justice Bevin pointed out Brooks case, typically the landowner's duty to keep premises reasonably safe and to warn only arises when a landowner knew or by the exercise of reasonable care should have known of the existence of the dangerous condition. That's the All case and the Tomroff case being quoted. And the simple fact is there's no evidence that the plaintiff has presented that shows that the defendant was aware of a dangerous condition there. They don't say how long it lasted. They don't provide any evidence of what was reasonable or unreasonable about the conduct of Riverbend or Mr. Dye. They just ask you to fill in the gaps. And this isn't an inference that they're asking you to take. This is flat out asking you to create evidence, to assume evidence that does not exist in this record. And without some notice, without some indication, for example, that one of the food vendors had said, hey, you've got a light out back here, you better get that fixed. Or, you know, the lights didn't turn on when they were supposed to, or somebody just shut them off and we need them turned back on. None of that exists. That did not happen here. And without some notice to Riverbend, no duty arises to them to warn of a dangerous condition that they do not know about.
But they can't blame themselves. The standard is what they should have known. And if you're telling somebody to use a door to exit a facility, should you have known? Isn't that a jury question?
Well, no. I think it's a question of presenting some evidence that there was a reason that they should have investigated that.
If you're telling somebody that you have to go out that door, or you're requested to go out that door, shouldn't they investigate?
Well,
I mean, I think that's a jury question.
We don't know that he didn't investigate and that the lights were on when he was there. That's not the
well, that's now you're drawing inferences. And those are inferences.
Sorry?
Now you're drawing inferences.
No, I'm pointing
that's
out
what you just suggested, and that's an inference to the detriment of Packer.
What I'm pointing out is there's no evidence of what he did do. Plaintiff did not put that on to show that he was not acting reasonably. And that is their burden to show that there was an unreasonable act or unreasonable conduct on the part of Riverbend.
Well, I think it's a jury question, but I think you're making the burden too high for a plaintiff under these circumstances. I don't think that's the law. I think the law suggests that if you had your representative, Riverbend's representative, saying, I went out and looked at it, and at 4:30, when it was getting dark, the light was on. And so I had no reason to believe that Ms. Packer wouldn't be able to egress the facility in the way that I had suggested to her.
Well, I would suggest, Justice Stegner, that that's changing the law of Idaho. Because as a defendant, I can challenge the inadequacy of proof as to duty and inadequacy of the plaintiff's proof as to breach of duty. Those are the issues that we're talking about, and those are the facts that should have been put on by the plaintiff in order to show that a duty arose in River Bend and that, in fact, they breached that duty. They did not present that. Now, remember, as a defendant, I am not burdened with the requirement to come forward with evidence to show my summary judgment is correct. I can rely on the fact that the plaintiff has failed to meet her prima facie case after I show the court that there is no evidence of duty or breach of duty. Now, here's the interesting thing about this case. The plaintiff has never moved at one time to modify their complaint, to amend it in response to this summary judgment, never moved under 56F to take a deposition or to conduct any discovery from the defendant to determine these issues. They just went along with the case as they had. Now, that's a decision they make. That's their tactical decision. But what it has left them with is they have not proven their case as to duty arising in this defendant. They have not proven evidence to support a claim of breach of duty. They have to show that we were unreasonable in the manner in which we addressed this.
Well, Mr. Browning, I don't mean to speak for Mr. Browning, but I think Mr. Browning is suggesting that he's not bringing a premises liability case. He's bringing a restatement second, section 311, negligent misrepresentation, where there's a risk of physical harm. And if that's the case, why doesn't a duty arise, and why should summary judgment have been granted if negligent misrepresentation where physical harm is a risk is the law of Idaho?
Well, it isn't the law of Idaho because section 311 requires more. It requires first and foremost that the person given the advice does that as a part of their profession and that they give the advice.
No, you're talking to, I understand there's a, we have only said negligent misrepresentation applies in cases of professional responsibility. Section 311 talks about physical harm, not economic harm. I think those are two vastly different negligent misrepresentations. We haven't ever endorsed or embraced 311. The question is, why shouldn't we?
Well, because this isn't the right case for it. Let me put it that way. Because what 311 says is you have to be, in order for that section to be triggered, it has to be a person who by their profession gives advice to an individual.
I think you're conflating 311 with negligent misrepresentation in a professional context. 311 talks about misrepresentation when physical harm results. We're not talking about a professional misrepresentation. We're talking about a negligent misrepresentation in which somebody is injured physically.
And maybe I'm misreading it, but as I read section 311, it imposes a duty on one whose profession or business is to give information related to bodily security to another. It's very narrow. And so I would suggest that that's not the facts we have, and this would not be the case to adopt 311, because it is very narrow as to what the professional is. And we're just back to the same situation that we have, after a fashion anyway, in Idaho's common law. What we're dealing with is very narrow special relationships. This is an even more narrow special relationship, I submit, than what we have before. We've talked about this negligent misrepresentation applying to accountants or to insurance agents. And those are the only two I'm aware of. We don't fall within that sort of a special relationship. There is no special relationship between Ms. Packer and River Bend or Mr. Dye that would justify even considering a special relationship type exception.
And so, sir, at this point in time, your time has up. I think you have fully answered Justice Stegner's question, and I thank you for your argument here today. How much time does the appellant have?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir, you may proceed.
Thanks, Your Honor.
I don't believe it'll be 12 minutes, but if I may just respond to a couple of things. as the respondent wished to spend the bulk of his time arguing licensee and invitee, I would indicate there was no dispute in the arguments in this case that there was a business purpose for both parties, for Riverbend and for Nicole Packer in renting that space. Matter of fact, in the summary judgment argument at page 42, line 25 through 43, line 3, I'll just read that. The court stated as to Nicole Packer, quote, "She was there for business. I don't think there's any dispute about that." And Mr. Browning, quote, "So was the defendant." And then the court, quote, "I understand that." There wasn't any dispute. Both sides had a business purpose in that relationship. I think the justices here have pretty much fleshed that out. As Justice Stegner mentioned, that isn't there an inference that there's a business purpose? Yes, there is when two parties are involved in something like that. And that's right out of Prosser, that there is an inference that if the two parties are right together, you know, entering into a relationship like that, there's an inference that there's a business purpose. As I was looking through Prosser last night, looking over what we're going to be talking about today, it was right in there. I didn't mention it earlier because it didn't come up and I had cited in my brief, but yes, that's right out of Prosser. Defendant seems to want to have all inferences in favor of the moving party on summary judgment, and that's not my understanding of how our court system works. One of the things that I would mention to the court, the defense tries to, gave a quote from a deposition of Nicole Packer, where she was cross-examined on her statement that she was directed by Mr. J. Dye, you know, to use that one exit. She stated in there several times that was her understanding of what he said. Was that she had to use that exit. She said that in the strongest terms. You know, the defendant hasn't even put on Jay Dye to refute that. We have the, this is just summary judgment. The question is whether we have any evidence that is what he said. Yes, we do. And again, this is summary judgment. The defendant kept speaking in terms of proving our case. This is summary judgment. You know, the question is whether we have facts. There are facts that if the defendant or respondent, wishes to address to a jury, that's fine. But we're on summary judgment again, and the question is whether the plaintiff has a case. And yes, clearly the plaintiff does. With that, I'm very surprised that the respondent even mentioned the fact that food vendors went in and out that door on the loading dock, without incident, so therefore it's safe. He's talking about the morning, where there's light on. But when the light is not on, that's a different matter. Our person was directed to leave by that exit. Now, the respondent had mentioned that the plaintiff came in through the front door. Initially, as far as she knew, that was the only door that was open at that time. And then she brought in some of her things through the west door. And after she did that, she was directed by Mr. Dye, "Don't do that anymore. You use that door over there." So I think it's absolutely meaningless for the respondent to point out that she had earlier used other doors. The fact is, after doing that, Jay Dye told her, "Don't do that. Use that door. Use the south door." And that's what happened, and that's why she did use that door instead of the other doors. And I think that's all I have to say about that. So with that, I submit the case to the justices of the Supreme Court. I thank you for your attention today.
Well, thanks, Alan. John, it was great seeing you this morning. This is an interesting case for sure. And it is now under advisement and we will render decision. Court's in recess. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.